copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
The title of this is, Why Non-Believers Do Not Take Their Beliefs Seriously. I'm going to argue that that's also true of believers. We have lost the sense of commitment to an idea. So I'll state something, not necessarily that I'll prove it, but I suspect that even in the evangelical world, we are more apt to be committed to a cause than we are to an idea. More committed to a cause than an idea. So I'd like to get involved in this cause over here without understanding the idea that has given rise to the cause. All right, that's what I'm saying. Now, so why do unbelievers, why don't they take their beliefs seriously, and then we'll see, is there any kind of extension to Christians? Now, I begin with a view that was held by Schaeffer and by Lewis, and that is that reality is a great tester of truth. Lewis says you may deceive yourself, but reality will straighten you out at some point. Schaeffer said that the truth of reality is the first thing that we begin when we engage the unbeliever. So the importance of reality, and of course reality has undergone great, how we view reality has undergone great change with the existentialism and what you call postmodernity, how we view reality. So we're living in that sort of a philosophical situation. But three factors that I would want to talk about and then go on to something else is today one's view of reality has been affected, which in turn affects how beliefs about reality are viewed. Okay? Now, three factors have contributed to this. The first would be pluralism. Okay? Now, what I would argue here is that pluralism has had a leveling effect in our culture, so that there is not one belief that stands above another belief. So if all beliefs are, well, let me back up. If reality is in your own head, your reality is good as anybody else's. And if beliefs are attached to reality, then your beliefs about your reality are as good as my beliefs about my reality. And this has this leveling effect. And this was permitted, maybe not caused, but at least permitted, by naturalism. When you lose the transcendent, you lose the notion of the sacred. And when you lose the notion of the sacred, you end up with a disordered society. Because now, everybody's beliefs are equal to anybody else's beliefs. Nothing stands over above another belief. So beliefs do not stand, my belief can't stand above yours, and that would pertain not just to everyday life, it pertains to religious things as well. So why isn't my belief as good as your belief, religiously speaking, say? So that has been what I would call the leveling effect of pluralism. Everybody's good. Everybody's belief. The other one is toleration, as it's practiced, is also leveled beliefs. Now, toleration as a principle, I'm quite willing to admit that I admit to that. By that I mean, I think that if a Jehovah's Witness wishes to build a building in my community, then I ought to allow that. There's no reason. That's what I think tolerance would the consequence of tolerance. But that's not the way tolerance is really viewed when you see it in the context of pluralism. Here, the idea of tolerance is, and it's a very one-sided thing, I might say, that not only are your beliefs as good as my beliefs, that the end of beliefs is not so taken so seriously because everybody's belief is about the same. So I should tolerate your belief. And I should, now it's one thing to tolerate your belief, but toleration now means that you should not try to convince another that your belief is better than their belief, okay? You can't do that. See? So that's how toleration. So perceived consequences become diminished. A third thing, and here I am again, you might guess that I've been doing a considerable amount of study in whole issues of technology. That's where I've sort of turned my attention over the last several years. Media technology, in particular social media, has altered the way we all think about reality. And I'm going to unpack that one because I think that's the one that may be less understood. And this altering of how you and I view reality because of social media is what we call mediated reality, a mediated reality. I think I mentioned that because it gets the least amount of press. Now, how does this mediated reality change us? Well, let me say first that mediation is dealing with reality through something else, which affects the way we experience the world and ourselves in it. Okay, so a mediated reality could be something like a video game, where I have some sort of a virtual reality. I'm killing people, etc. Or not. I might be doing something quite good. I'm just not familiar with those videos themselves. Now, what mediated reality does is it shields me from the other. Okay. So I get to deal with it through, in this case, through the screen. So I'm not, who's in control? Well, I'm in control. If I don't want to do it anymore, what do? I switch channels, I put in another game, whatever, but I'm the one who's in control. Now, what this ends up doing is celebrating the self in public space. You've heard about the selfie. That really just helps you. When I say selfie, it's kind of said it all, right? The social media in particular celebrates the self. Anybody can put whatever they want to on the internet, and they can do so, maintain anonymity. They can say anything they want without fear of any kind of, for the most part, legal or moral ramifications. And one of the Jaron Lanier. Lanier is the one who in 1986 actually developed this thing we call virtual reality. He is now traveling literally around the world warning major corporations about the danger of virtual reality and social media. And he does some of his argument by looking at the last presidential election in the United States and says that social media has destroyed political discourse. And it's a very interesting thing. I would also, and I wouldn't have time for this, I wanted to do some studies. And there's just simply, we don't have enough data yet to do this. I've tried to look at what does a revolution look like that was started with social media, okay? Such as in Egypt, Libya. As opposed to a revolution such as was had in Eastern Europe, the late, 1989, 90, in that time. What is interesting, and if it holds true, and I don't know that it does, I'm just saying we're getting first blushes here, it seems that revolutions that are instigated and supported, sustained by social media, tend to be less stable and sustainable after it's all over. Egypt would be an example of this. Again, not enough. I've contacted a lady at Stanford University, and I said, can you help me? And she said, well, I think you're onto something, but, you know, there's just not enough information. We're going to have to wait a while to see whether or not there is any kind of correlation. Is it, you know, is it really a causal relationship here, or is it just an associative relationship? I don't know. I can't say at this time. So what ends up happening is that life becomes increasingly self-referential. Now, I'm not picking on anybody, and you think, you bring up evangelicals, the reason I do is because I have a heart for the church. I don't do it to be critical. I'm a churchman at heart. I could have taught in several other places when I decided to teach full-time. I chose to teach in a seminary. I'm not saying what anybody else should do. I'm a churchman. The church is what Christ purchased with his blood. The church is the ground and the pillar of truth. If we fail, there is no other group, institution if you wish to call it, that is responsible for giving and holding forth and defending the truth. So I don't, when if I mention evangelicals, I am one, I don't do that to be, you know, just to be sitting off of the side and shooting at people. I just use it as an example of where I think some of the difficulties are beginning to arise. If you listen to young people who go on mission trips, right? And so the short-term mission trips. But it's not just young people, it's adults as well. When they come back, they stand up in the church and they give a testimony. Listen carefully. It's almost always about what did it mean to me. Now, folks, have we thought about that? That's what William Carey was thinking about. What does it mean to me? I don't think so. So it just shows how the selfie, we are, what did it do to me? When Princess Diana was, when she was killed in the automobile accident, it wasn't about her, it was about everybody else. You know, where was I when it happened? How was I feeling? That's an indication, folks, that the focus has shifted to me, and I think that social media in particular has had its part. Mediated reality misrepresents the human condition by showing a finished product as if it were actually the one-time act per person unfolding of history. How could any young lady ever measure up to the young lady she sees in the glamour shows? It's just absolutely impossible. Everything is just right. Or you see a commercial, or you see something on movie, and, oh, that was such a clever response. Yes. And how many takes did it take to get it on film? Oh, well, who knows? See, you and I don't have that privilege. There is no pause button, no rewind button. Let's do that again, all right? I said to you, I think you're stupid. Oh, I didn't mean that. Let's hit the rewind button, and that will erase everything, and I'm going to say it one more time. I think you're a wonderful person. We don't get those options. But mediated reality gives us that option, okay? And I'm saying it's destroying the way we view reality. Another thing that I would just mention is this idea of where popular TV shows actually are woven into the reality. So let's say, 21? That may not be. It was a movie, 24, I think. 24 Hours or something. There was a movie like that. And it was a serial movie. And everybody got caught up in there. What is so-and-so? What's he going to be? Is he going to get out of the mess today? Is he going to be able to make it? Well, Good Morning, I think it was Good Morning America. They're sitting around talking about this TV program as if it was really going to happen. As if it was part of reality. Well, do you think so-and-so is going to get out of this mess tonight? Who cares? It's script. But you see, there's a merging where we can't distinguish between what is reality and what is representational. That's what I mean by this. So the reality shows. It creates what I'm doing some work in this, this whole idea that I was put on by Roger Scruton in his book, The Face of God. But I remember Lewis writes, Men Without Chest. Social media is creating men without faces. It is in the face that our humanity is first recognized. You never have seen a deceptive elbow, but you have seen a deceptive face. So when we talk to people, we read them, don't we? What do we read? Well, we read off their face. And consequently, there's no, in this mediated reality, there is no place for the human soul as citizens held to the belief increase continually in this material wealth would compensate them for a culture that insulted their self-respect. So I think this, again, I'm not a Luddite. I'm not saying we got to do away. We got to protest with Facebook. No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying we're not very cautious about the way we're using it. I think it runs the risk of creating a society where humanity is being lost. Where, do you realize that there are homes where people communicate by texting? Joe, the boy, is in the living room, mom is in the kitchen, and how does he communicate with her? He texts. I think, folks, we have just crossed the line. You say, well, what's wrong with it? It's just texting. But what does it do to humanity? How do we break apart and lose this sense of looking into your face, looking into your mother's face, looking into your son's face? In this context, that Christians must communicate the truth of Christianity, the reality of God. So I'll just say that. Do you now see how difficult it is for us as Christians to talk about a historic Christ, a historic faith that really happened? As Schaeffer said, if you'd rubbed your hand on the cross, you'd have gotten a splinter in it. Because the whole idea of real reality, to use one of Schaeffer's phrases, real reality, has now been merged with a mediated reality. So how in the world do we communicate the truthfulness? So what the church is trying to do, and I understand what they're trying to make the gospel real. So we do it by having drama and this and that. Why are we having to do that? We're trying to make the gospel real. It's real. Why are we crying so loud? Because we're now realizing that we're talking to people and they don't understand. So if the reality people are dealing with, then you see beliefs don't really matter. And I would say that carries over into our witnessing. I think I've run out of my time. So questions or comments? I would like pushback or anything, yes.
Just a quick footnote. As being a pastor and being in France where people enjoy disagreeing.
Yes.
They no longer do it face-to-face. They do it over the internet. And we finally got to a place where we would not send emails back and forth to people unless you first talked to them face-to-face.
Very interesting. So in France, people who may want to disagree, kind of a cultural thing, we don't do it face to face, we do it by the internet. So what do you think is lost?
Oh, it's horrible.
Yeah.
You never make any progress.
No.
You can't.
And the fact
you read so much into it that's not there, or vice versa.
Absolutely. And you lose the person.
Oh, yeah.
With the person helps to temper me. When I look into your eyes and I'm talking with you, that shapes not only what I say, but how I say it. You won't know how many times I get emails from students. It's just plain disrespectful. So I write back and said, son, my dear, I know you probably didn't mean it, But this comes across as being quite disrespectful. And of course, when it's pointed out to them, they'll go, Dr. Miller, I didn't mean that. Well, I suspect you didn't. But the fact is that this medium of explaining or dealing with a major issue, you're not explaining yourself well, and if we'd been face-to-face, you would have seen my look. And you would have said, whoops, sort of thing. So, yeah, that sort of thing is lost. Real men of God speak face-to-face, yeah. The importance of face. See how many times you read in the Old Testament about the face of God. Don't turn your face from me. Let your face shine upon me. And so as Christians, we've got to realize that this really is an issue. It's not just, you say, well, you're getting the same information out. No, you're losing the point. And I would think that as Christians, that we would be the ones who could recognize that. And if anybody's going to stand up and gently, and I don't think we stand up and do a campaign to get rid of social media. What I think we do is we operate the church differently. And somebody says, well, why do you do that? I say, well, because I respect. I respect humanity. I have a policy. Students want to talk to me, you don't email me. You have a concern about your grade, you must come into my office, let's talk face to face. So here we have a young person giving testimony that, yes, this does interfere. So if you go to a restaurant, you're talking about, well, it's interfere with true person-to-person social contact. So if you go to a restaurant, how many times do you see mom and dad and the children all with their phones out? And yet, how important is the table? Say, once again, folks, that's just something we've lost. Evangelicals ought to retrieve it. How important is the table? How important is it to have meals together? What's the last thing Jesus does? Well, I mean with his disciples. He has a meal with them. If any of you have not read, you might read, Joseph Pieper, Leisure, the Basis of Culture. He's a German, wrote it in 1949. But he deals a lot with this very issue as well. Long before, but he was talking about it on principle. See, my wife and I walk every night. I try to run 4 miles. I do that every other day. And then every night my wife and I walk for 2 miles every day. It's just amazing. Husband and wife, if they are walking, they've got earbuds. They're not talking to one another. They're listening to their music or whatever. Isn't that right? It's whose music? It's my playlist. You don't buy an album anymore. You just pick out what you want. Why? Well, you're the one that's important. They're not. So the question is, how is the church in America addressing this? That's the fact they're not. In fact, when I deliver these kind of lectures, which I did in my own seminary, everybody was pretty quiet. And I didn't receive any nice email from anybody saying, that was great. Because what we've come to believe is that all of this is just the way the world is, and that's where we have to communicate now, so we just need to get in step with what everybody else is doing. And after all, it is effective, and it is convenient. So those same values, criteria come. And this really burdens me. You realize even now, there are companies that will not permit you to take an iPad, a telephone, into a board meeting. How it we're like Pavlov's dog. If it dings, I mean, we don't know what else is going on in the room until we get this out and check, right? Oh, you know, it's an email from the coupon company. I've got 6 coupons waiting for me, and we've broken concentration. Or you just somebody who's they're talking to you and they're texting all the while they're talking to you. Don't you feel offended by that? What I think the big thing is, we're losing our humanity. And if anybody should be concerned about that, we should. With progress, as I talked about earlier, you've got all these choices, and it's unfortunate that they're coming at a time when our moral fiber, at least in America, seems to be almost an all-time weakness. Did you have a question? I won't say where, but I can tell you that I can go in a gathering of evangelical adults, and they'll be doing the same thing. totally offensive. I taught at another school in Europe, and we had students who simply, all the time they were in the class, were simply on their computers, Googling or whatever. Everybody but one person failed. And then guess what? They blamed me. I'm sorry. You didn't even listen. An analogy that I would use, I think it's pretty much, if I'm talking with you, and we're standing somewhere, right? And we're talking, and I'm all of a sudden looking. There's a crowd of people around, and I'm looking this way, and I'm looking that way. I'm not keeping eye contact with them, looking here, looking there. What are you thinking?
Listening.
I'm not listening, and I'm looking for what?
Stop.
Maybe somebody else to even to talk to, right? Don't you find that offensive? Well, you see, you're losing the face-to-face. We feel dehumanized when that happens, disrespected when that happens. So I want to do a balance. And as I said in the other lecture, my concern is that the evangelical church, going to the questions the lady asked, this isn't even on their radar. Because we have assumed, back to your point, we have assumed that there's no relationship between the medium and the message. We have assumed that technology is totally neutral. And yet there's so much evidence. In fact, studies have been done about the internet. I could quote them. Stanford, they've been done by major universities, and we realize that people have a greater sense of isolation and loneliness now with the internet than they did before. Why? Because we were made as social beings. And, you know, if you've got a grandchild and the only way you communicate with him is that you can do it by Skype, that's wonderful, okay? But that's not how you build the relationship. It's better than nothing. But to assume that we can maintain and continue relationships only by doing that, I just think we're really fooling ourselves. So we've got to think about, what are we going to do with the technology? Just because it makes it more convenient, is it something we just necessarily need to do? If we're going to counsel you, right? So you say, well, it's really pretty inconvenient for us to have to meet for coffee. So let's just do it by Facebook. Oh, wonderful. But the notion is that all that counts is that information is dispensed. But we as Christians know that we're made in the image of God. And that there is a thing, there's a concept that's called humanity. And even the unbeliever has humanity. We should be concerned about what we do and how we may trample on that sort of thing. So I think your question is, I just don't think the evangelical church is even concerned about it. Well, they may soon or later. You know, if there was a time when the basic complaint against internet, that sort of thing, was, oh, you can get on, you can get pornography, and oh, you can waste so much time on, and those things are all still true. But I think there's something more profound that is now going on with all of this. Particularly, there's a gentleman, I don't even think you should want to read his book. His name is Thomas Zengatia. But he has written a book called Mediated, How the Media Shapes Your World and the Way You Live in It. Now, he's got kind of a vile tongue, or I should say pen, and so it's sometimes a little rough reading. But he's not a Christian. He just sees these. He's a journalist actually, and he just sees this is the real. These are some real dangers, you know, that we're facing. So his whole concept is that the fear of the mediated reality. Look what happened to Kathy. Now I'm probably talking about something that many of you would not know, but Mr. Kathy was the CEO of a food chain called Chick-fil-A. And he made a comment, it's just something that they would not support. He said nothing about homosexuality. He just said that their company would not be giving money to support homosexuality. And the internet lit up. And guess what? Within a few weeks, he changed his course. We have seen companies put out of business. You can say anything you want to on the internet. Really? There's no peer review. You have total anonymity for the most part. How many young people have committed suicide over the last few years because of the internet? What we call bullying on the internet. Now, I know we don't prove anything by those sort of things, but it should raise our attention and say, wait a minute now. You know, is there something that's not real right here? All right, well, thank you so much.